Okay, so let's get the afternoon session underway, and welcome and thank you for joining us for this afternoon's session, and join us in our fireside chat on PMO as a service. So you're right, we don't have a fire here. I think I'm going to have to move away for the... Is that better? Okay. So we don't have a fire. We don't have a couple of leather sofas to sit on. Don't have a couple of Labradors sort of taking a snooze after a walk in the countryside. And unfortunately, we don't have a glass of scotch to enjoy the fireside with. But what we do have is two very interesting colleagues of mine who've been working on this concept of PMO as a service. And just before I make some introductions, I'd like to ask you a few questions. How many of you have a PMO in your organization? Okay. How many of you have a PMO that is well-defined, governed effectively, clear roles, responsibilities, well-resourced? Yeah. Probably the most telling question.
Excellent.
Adding value.
I'm going to bring you guys up.
Adding value to your organization on a daily basis. All of the above? Not as many as how many had a PMO. And how many of the PMOs are staffed internally? Okay. How many have contractors, consultants staffing the PMOs? Okay. And final one, how many actually outsource the PMO to a third-party organization? None. Interesting. So I think you can see from that that there's a variety of... Most of you got PMOs, but there's a variety of ways in which you deliver the PMOs to your organization. So just a quick introduction of myself first. My name is Peter Wilson, and I'm the head of consulting services for P-Cubed globally. And if you're wondering where my slightly strange accent comes from, it comes from the valleys of South Wales in the United Kingdom. And we've got a very cosmopolitan team up here today, and you'll find out when we introduce the rest of the team. Just quickly, got the slides. Very quick introduction to P-Cubed. We've been running for 20 years now. We were founded in 1994. We probably are Microsoft's oldest partner in the EPM space.
Well then, good morning.
I'm going to stand in. Does this make any difference? Can you still hear me? Yeah? No? Is that better? Okay. So we are probably the fastest growing consultancy in this space. So we've got about 1,200 consultants that operate globally. And we provide a range of consulting services to help businesses transform their organizations through the media of program project management. And in many instances, that's supported by Microsoft Project Server implementations. And we work with probably about 50% of the Fortune 100 companies. So we've got a very large blue chip clientele that we work for. Okay, enough about P-Cubed. We move on. I'm very pleased to welcome here from one of our long-standing clients, Chevron, Konstantin Popov. Konstantin, tell us about yourself.
Hello, everyone. My name is Konstantin Popov. I work for Chevron. I'm in downstream and chemicals, where I have the responsibility for looking after our portfolio projects for chemical companies. And I also have responsibility for working on processes and tools for our PMO. And part of my job is to stand up Microsoft Project Server 2013 across all of the operating companies in downstream and chemicals. A couple of words about Chevron. Chevron is one of the leading energy providers. We are active in about 180 countries. Our daily production is about 2.6 million barrels of oil equivalent per day. And our refining capacity about 1.9 million barrels per day. 75% of our production comes from outside of the United States, so most of our projects are global in nature, and we work with large distributed teams to complete them. Prior to that, I worked in transportation industry, where I was fortunate to deploy a web-based PPM system and work with the largest shipping companies and container operators. Before that, I spent 6 years with Vodafone. I spent a lot of my time in Europe and managed the integration of Vodafone Life platform. Before that, in the 90s, was a number of startups, and prior to that, some military experience.
Thanks, Konstantin. And just to say, Konstantin's accent doesn't come from the valleys of South Wales. He's actually from Russia. And with Konstantin, we've got Ken Prush, who's a colleague of mine at P-Cube and has been working with Chevron and other major companies for many years.
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Ken Prush. I am one of our senior consultants at P-Cube. Over my time with P-Cube, I've had the opportunity to actually travel the world and work in a variety of different countries as well as a variety of different industries. I helped the Australian Chevron team rebuild their ISPMO in anticipation of some very large oil and gas projects they were putting in place out there. I've worked in high tech, I've worked in finance, healthcare, media, manufacturing. So I've had a lot of opportunities to see PMOs that work and PMOs that struggle. And so I've kind of gotten a sense of the good, the bad, and the ugly of what PMOs need to do to succeed. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. So just quickly on the format of the session, we've got a few prepared questions and a few slides to support the answers to the questions. But then towards the end of it, we really want to open it up to yourselves and get yourselves engaged and maybe share some of your experiences as well with what your PMOs are doing and how they're actually delivering value to your organization. The slides will be available. And if you do want the slides, if you could just leave your business card with one of our team at the back, then we'll get those sent through to you. So in terms of the first question, I'll pose this one to Ken. What is PMO as a service, and how does it differ from a traditional PMO?
Certainly. And just as a side note, we didn't, as Peter said, we didn't get the fire, but if any of you are smokers, if you want to put up your lighters in any moment, give us that sort of rock star experience, it'd make me feel good. So before we jump into the PMO as a service, let's just sort of talk about two fundamental truths of project management organizations. The first one is that plan minus governance plus time equals variance. You know, I go into a lot of project management organizations and I ask them, how do you manage your projects? And oftentimes they have very detailed answers. Oh, yes, we have this. So here's a process document. We have resource roles. We have stoplight definitions. We have a PMO website. We have all these rules and techniques and tricks that our PMs utilize to execute our projects. I then go speak to the project managers. How do you execute projects within this organization? And I often get a very different answer than what the official line might be. My favorite example is I was working for a media company down here in Los Angeles, and I asked them the question, you know, what project methodology do you use? And they had five competing methodologies in use simultaneously in this organization. One was based on PMBOK, one was PRINCE2 from their French arm, one was sort of this weird Frankenstein amalgamation of the two. They had a home-cooked solution that some enterprising young gentleman had put together, and then they had sort of a light version of that. So they've got five different methodologies, all with slightly different values and different metrics that they're reporting on, and I asked their PMs, you know, how do you manage projects? And I spoke to a group of four of them, and the first one, he was a PMP, so he tended to use some sort of lightweight version of the PMBOK. One of them had a software background, so he used sort of an agile hybrid where he would sort of work in Team Foundation Server and sort of spit out some data to a project schedule. One of them was a brand new project manager who had just joined the company recently, and they had a tool called One Page Project Manager, which is basically this little cheat sheet for projects where he would just dump some metrics and then promptly never report on it again. And the fourth person was a business analyst who had been pulled into the role of a PM, and her world was Excel, so she did her work in Excel. So one group, five methodologies, four PMs, four different approaches to project management. So why is that a problem? Well, when you're dealing with just projects, you can understand the health of a project simply by looking at that project status. As long as they're maintaining consistent information, there's not a problem. The issue becomes magnified when you escalate this data to a program, to a portfolio, and to an enterprise. When you are a C-suite executive looking at a piece of paper and you don't know what a red here versus a yellow there means, what rules and statuses they use, is this 2-week-old data, is it 2-month-old data, you lose the ability to make very critical decisions based on the information you're receiving. I used the example here, even something as simple as the estimate of completion formula might be very different from PM to PM. You know, project management, for those of you who are project managers, it's as much an art as it is a science. And so you've probably learned good or bad practices over the years that you just bring with you from group to group. And unless there's a strong governance model in place, those habits will just be your operating model without any sort of enforcement of a common set of standards. Which brings me to my second point. America may run on Duncan, but project organizations run on data. So the bare bones of your project organizations are the schedules that the PMs keep. They have your resourcing, they have your forecast, they have your cost, and they have your deliverables. Ultimately, they have your organization's success in their hands. But when you're looking at this data that has now become very diffuse and very different from PM to PM, you start to struggle with the ability to do forecasting, to do resource management, to do optimization. And ultimately, without a strong governance model, it tends to fall to project managers to provide this data to your portfolio organizations. And PMs, well, they have their own sort of challenges when it comes to reporting on project information, in my personal experience. So thank you for the sympathy laugh. And this is the point where an organization says, we need a PMO. Let's bring a PMO in. They will give us this process and this methodology, and this will be the solution to our problems. So this is generally not the case. As the show of hands indicated, a lot of PMOs, not a lot of them working. Why is that? Well, first and foremost, what is a PMO? I could go around the room and ask 20 different people in here, what does your PMO do? And I could probably get 20 different answers. You know, they can do it. They can be centers of excellence. They can be portfolio tools. They can be mentors, coaches, schedulers, reporters. There's a lot that a PMO can do. And if you don't have a very strong definition of what a PMO does, what your PMO needs to deliver, you have no way to really understand how to staff that model, how to position that model in your organization. So a lot of people say, I want a PMO, and then promptly lose the steam to properly put it in their organization. As I said, you need the right skills for a PMO. If you're doing a lot of reporting, you might need business analysts. If you're a project manager, staffing organization, you don't want a lot of business analysts. You need PMs. So, the skills are critical. Their role in the organization. If you are a governance model and you have PMs and you're sort of floating out here in the void, you aren't part of that structure, that organizational structure that allows you to enforce governance on PMs. So what you get is a sort of a matrix environment that a lot of you probably operate in, where you have PMs that are reporting to the businesses and a PMO out here that's sort of being seen as this bureaucracy. You know, they're the guys that bug me every 2 weeks. I need to give them status reports. I need to give them data. I need to do all this consolidation that's just, it's a pain in the butt. And when you're not seen as offering value, you're just seen as being a burden. So as a result, I'm sorry, I missed my last point there. A lot of the PMOs that I work with or I come into and see, I've been reduced to a reporting role. All you do is collect the data, and then you regurgitate it down the road for whoever wants to read it. And when you're reduced to being a reporting entity, it's very hard to justify why you belong in the organization. So what's the PMO as a service, and why is it different? First and foremost, it's much easier to define the role of the PMO. You provide services for projects. You provide schedulers. You provide resource management, risk analysis. A PMO can do a lot of things, and a PMO as a service can grow. But first and foremost, you make projects better. In the example that Constantine will talk to in a few minutes, we actually use project controllers at Chevron. These are people who go into the projects as part of the project teams and help with scheduling, reporting, so on and so forth. So they are now part of the project team, not a layer above it, but part of that team at their meetings, in the reports, generating good information for them. There's potentially a cost value. You can defray some of the cost of the PMO to the projects. That doesn't work for every organization, but it is an option. But I think, really the key point, sort of skipping down to the bottom, is that the PMO as a service does not promote bureaucracy. It focuses on delivering value to the projects that they support. Peter?
Ken, thanks very much for that. I was going to introduce Ken as having an American accent, but he said, no, it's a New York accent. So I'm sure that'll mean something.
I apologize if you're missing key points.
He does talk fast. Constantine, so we've heard Ken sort of consultant, global, been everywhere, done it all. What did you do in Chevron to help design your PMO?
Specifically, industrial chemicals, like I said, we have 400 plus projects. And sometimes our project management capability is limited because it's hard to find 400 plus project managers to manage all these projects. So you get BAs, BRM, system analysts to manage your projects. And our capability is inconsistent. While they're great at the daytime job, the project management is not where we want it to be. So as a result, we had a mixed bag of project outcomes. So we set out on a journey and started with a study that we conducted with P-Cubed to identify where do we stand in terms of the project management capability and our portfolio of projects. And we identified a number of opportunities around people, processes, and tools, resource optimization, and reporting. People, like I said, inconsistent project management capability, around processing tool, inconsistent use of templates, inconsistent use of reporting, and the outcomes and the experience to our stakeholders varied greatly. And with the reporting, we have, and I think many of you do, a PowerPoint-based reporting, right? Data is aggregated in Excel spreadsheets from various sources. You crunch the data for a couple of weeks, and then you put it into a PowerPoint and present it to your stakeholders or to your senior management. We want to move away to a data-driven reporting format where we can have an accurate and timely set of data that we can present to any level of stakeholders for timely and accurate decision-making. The approach that we took, like Ken said, we have introduced a new role, project controllers, to augment our project management capability. And it's a new role for us. And these people are focusing on providing services around scheduling, budget, and reporting. And in order to provide the value, we needed to come up with a consistent approach how they can do that. We do have a number of very good templates that we use throughout of the organization, but everybody slightly modifies the template, what suits them, you know, based on the size of the project. So now everybody have a set of their own templates, and the farther you get away from the center, you know, the more of the variance you will see. So we needed to have a way to lock it down at a system level. And this is where the Microsoft Project Server came in, because we were able to create a schedule that is role-based and effort-loaded, and we can filter it out based on the complexity and the size of the project to give the project manager or a controller all of the required compliant tasks, and also give them an opportunity to see how many resources they will need by type to complete this project. And by stacking these project proposals with projects that we already have in flight, give us an opportunity to forecast the resources by type for the future, right? We allocate the money in the beginning of the year, but we didn't necessarily know, are we gonna have enough resources of certain types to complete these projects? And as a result, you know, we come to the mid-year and all of a sudden we're looking for 27 BAs, 4 project managers, 60 .NET developers. We come to our ADM partner and say, we need these resources today, right? So the introduction of the system also gives us an opportunity to become a better partner. We also came up with a standard way to manage cost across all of the projects. So right now, if we can report, if anybody looks at the CPI on their project or across the portfolio, we all know that we are using a consistent way to generate this number, so this reporting is accurate. Resource management, like I said, we have about 1,300 resources in our resource pool. We were able to define standard roles for all of these resources, and we now know what our people are working on, so we have an accurate resource utilization view, but we're also able to forecast resources by type. Scalability. Downstream and Chemicals is an enterprise. We have 6 operating companies within that, and we're deploying Microsoft Project Server across all of these, all of the OpCos. It gives us an opportunity to have the view not only for a very specific business unit, a portfolio, program, but also across portfolios. And it's very powerful because it allows for us to manage our cost on an enterprise level, manage our resources on enterprise level. And I also want to mention that we are managing all of the work in Microsoft Project Server. We're managing all of our run operations, and we are managing all of our project work. We came up with a way where we can allocate the resources that are working on maintenance for an application 20% of their time. And after we assign all of the run operations work to our resources, give us an accurate view of how many resources are available to work on the projects as well. And the reporting, like I said, our goal was to move from the PowerPoint approach to a data-driven approach. We came up with a number of reports, both Excel-based, and we're using some views, both in a project server as well as in a standalone project, and we're developing some SSRS reports to provide data-driven reporting. You click a button, and all of our projects now have a standard project reporting template. So if you're a stakeholder on a project, and you're gonna get a consistent report time after time after time, it creates a norm, it creates an expectation, and it creates our capability. Because everybody now have an expectation. If we have consistent way of creating schedules, managing costs, doing our reporting, you know, within 6-7 months, it will become an expectation, right? It doesn't look like what I used to do from the system. Why not? It gives opportunity for executive to ask questions. Some of the lessons learned. The biggest lessons learned is that you need to ensure that you include all of the stakeholders. And what I mean, all of the stakeholders, you need to ensure that you have alignment across your top leadership team, why we're doing this, what are the reasons, what do we want to get out of this, what is the value. We also need to ensure that people that we're doing the work for, our business partners, understand why they're doing that and what's in it for them. Resource managers as well, and it was probably the most highly skeptical group. Okay, so now all of my resources will be in the system. Anybody going to come there and assign my resources? And the answer is no. The outside process of a conversation around who is working on what, who is available, is still there, but it's facilitated by the system. You're looking at real-time data. And so this engagement required a lot of change leadership. It's not just change management. You need to get in front of people. I'm not trying to sell them of the idea why we're doing this, but you need to demo it. So prototyping, and we have created the complete portfolio view, and we went out and we showed people what it means, right, what they can get out of that. What was the value for the people working on the project? What was the value for the people managing the project? What was the value for the CIOs? And if you continue to engage with folks and you continue to demo what you can do for them, and they see the value in it, they will be successful. But even if you do all of this, you will get some people that will want to sit in the back of the bus. They will be like, you know, we have too much going on. And it's a reality of life. If you have an audit going on in your team, you don't have any time for this. So you need to be mindful of people that are slow adopting the system and continue to work with them and continue to educate and show values that their peers in other teams are being able to recognize by using the system, by taking on the controllers, by using standard templates. Like I said, stakeholder management is the key.
You good? Thank you.
Ken, two questions. First one for clarification, really. I mean, when people talk about software as a service, infrastructure as a service, they tend to associate it with outsourcing. Mm-hmm. Is that what we're talking about here, or is it something different?
No, so certainly, and you know, I think that's actually a fairly salient point. You think of software as a service, you think about, you know, what is that? That usually means that you are sort of offshoring your software requirements, that it frees up an administrative burden for your organization. You don't have to have the infrastructure to manage the software. Or if you're doing infrastructure as a service, you know, you have someone else helping take this burden off you. And that's actually what the PMO as a service model does, except that instead of outsourcing outside your organization, you are allowing the PMO to come into your projects and actually support your project execution. You know, as I said earlier at Chevron, you know, these people are there. They, you know, there are PMs who are very talented PMs who are absolutely terrible schedule managers. And, you know, let's be honest. I mean, I don't know if there's anyone in the room that's a Microsoft employee. A lot of people don't make very good use of Microsoft Project Server or Microsoft Project because it's a lot of template crunch work, may not provide them a lot of value. They'd rather be out there managing their projects. So in come the controllers, they can manage the schedules. They can help with the resourcing. They take that burden off the PM so the PM can focus on working with his team, getting his or her deliverables done. So to kind of use that allegory of the software as a service, the PMO is coming in and relieving you of this administrative burden that might otherwise be seen as a very low value add for a project manager, but is incredibly critical for your project organization.
Okay, so value to the project manager from the guys who are delivering that service. Right. Okay, so the next question is, scope of PMO can be huge. How do you determine which components you need to run for your specific environment?
Sure. So I promise these are like the last slides we have for you guys. We want to get to your questions, and we want to engage you in the conversation. We just want to cover some of the groundwork here. So a PMO could do a lot of things. I mentioned this early when I first started out. This is just a small example of what you can do. Capacity management, mentoring and coaching, administrative support, benefits management. There is a wide, wide list of skills that a PMO might require in the execution of its duties. So if you come in and say, I want a PMO, and you get that, that's almost unachievable. So when we work with organizations like Chevron, we tend to use a variety of these sort of models that are stood up. And I'm just going to quickly go through just a few of them, just to help you kind of understand how we put your PMO in a box. So the CEB, the Corporate Executive Board, uses this four-step approach between coach, auditor, financial advisor, and player. And you can see on the board, it really relates to the level of involvement in execution and the degree of authority over risk management. So the PMO as a service tends to be in that player role up in the top. They're not just sitting off in the corner as coaches and providing best practices. They're actually down in there in the projects, taking a stake in execution, taking a stake in helping manage the project execution successfully. Cranfield University has a model that focuses more on operational and strategic versus supply and demand. And again, you can see how these, and there's a definitions up on the board where it tends to go. But you can see that, you know, in a PMO as a service, you tend to look more at the operational role. You don't provide, you know, conducting reviews and health checks. You're reporting on value. You're improving, you know, report progress, managing risk. So you, although you can have some elements of a strategic piece, the primary focus, again, is in that operational, in-the-trench success. PCUBE has a similar model where we categorize PMOs, guardian, partner, enabler, and coach. And again, you'll tend to see the PMO as a service gravitate to that upper right, upper left sort of quadrant where they have a great deal more influence in the actual project as opposed to a PMO that might simply be a governance mechanism. So we work with organizations. We put them through these sort of discussions around what they want their PMO to do, keep them focused on this notion of improving execution excellence as a way to help drive better organizational excellence. And we come up with a sort of example client analysis. This is not Chevron, but this is a sample. And you sort of see where your PMO will touch on operational and strategic project and portfolio areas. So now what we have is we have a starting list for your service catalog in a PMO. So now rather than saying, I want all that, I can say, I just want that. And that becomes a much more manageable way to staff a PMO, to define a PMO, and to sell the value of your PMO within an organization. And again, you'll kind of look here, and these are all very tactical things. Capacity management, helping with a tool management, project and program assurance. These are things that are immediately and tangibly beneficial to projects, as opposed to saying, give me your data every 2 weeks. You're now saying, I'm going to be in there in your project, helping you maintain your status, keeping your project healthy, and taking the burden off you to allow that reporting information to fall to me and then through me to our PMO. Thank you, Pierre.
Thank you. So it sounds like with the project controllers, you're moving a lot of the updating or administrative tasks from the project managers to the PMO. In our organization, we work with a lot of people that maybe you manage a project once every 6 months or once a year. And so we've got developers who, on the side, we don't have a PM, so they manage a project. Were you doing this with all of your project managers, or were you just taking the burden off of some of them? How did you make that decision of where it was right to step in with a controller and where you just work with the PMs to train them to be able to be self-sufficient?
Constantine?
So right now we are working with all of the projects, and the reason for that is we want to get all of the projects and data into the system. And what we found that project schedules were very inconsistent, and we couldn't just take that from individual projects, rework it, and put it into the system. Most of the projects were not resource leveled. A lot of the projects did not use milestones correctly, so just a lot of cleanup data. So we assigned all of the projects to a number of the controllers that are working across. Most of the controllers are working with, between 12 and 20 projects that they're assigned. And some are small, some are large. But the goal for us is to move it all into the system. And what we are doing also is that we are creating in the future is we're looking for the behaviors. If the project does not want to make use of the controller and say, you know what, I'm going to do it all myself. I am very competent. I understand what your requirements are. Which is going to hold people responsible because our reporting will be system-based reporting. We'll be able to highlight if projects are, if the PM is following, if we have the quality data, and if he's following our process or not. There is a follow-on question.
So as a follow-up to that, it feels like there's a lot of inefficiency here. The project manager has all of the data. He takes that data and he gives it to a controller, and then the controller updates the system. Are you moving towards your PMs just skipping that controller and having the information they need to be able to enter the data directly?
We have not seen that yet. The capability around Microsoft Project Server is very inconsistent, and we are going through a lot of training. We've conducted some training with Robert Happy there in the back, and we also have worked with SpeakCube to create a lot of the internal training that is actually based on the system they've configured for us, and which is extremely important. And we are delivering this training across various teams. We identified first resources across the organizational lines that are key: project managers, controllers. We're also doing training for very specific teams. We also have the administrator that we have on staff within my team that is helping us to make small changes. Sometimes people need to have a role added because this project makes use of some unique role that we just don't have in the system. And before, you would submit a remedy request, wait for about 3 weeks, and maybe it will happen. If you need a change in the report, you need to add an additional data type, and you need it now because your CIO is asking for it. And before, again, it will take a few weeks, and now we have an opportunity to quickly resolve changes. If you cannot load your project plan into the system, the same thing, right? We have somebody there who can resolve technical issues quickly to help with adoption. So at this point, we don't see people skipping because our capability is not there yet, and controllers are the ones that are controlling the system at this stage. Controllers and the PM that we have trained. If I open up the system to 1,100 people to make updates, data quality will suffer greatly, right? Mm-hmm. And in order to maintain the data quality at the initial stage, as well, we're going through all the training and all the our capability building, we have just a handful of people that are making updates within the system and maintaining these schedules. And I don't think there is, you mentioned that there is a PM to controller relationship. It's actually broader than that. A controller works with the team as well. They participate in the project management meeting. If it's a planning meeting and they talk about estimates, the controller is right there asking the questions. And so they get access to the data at the same time. There is no additional overhead for the PM to give all this data to the controller. It's not a funnel. It's a little broader.
Yeah, and just to add to that, he makes the very salient point. It's, again, you know, we actually see often an increase in efficiency because what tends to happen in the traditional model is that the team updates the PM and then the PM has to find time in his or her often extremely busy schedule, because you have PMs that are probably managing several projects, to knock out data out of a tool. Now, to your earlier question, does a controller work for every single project? The answer is no. If you have PMs that are very skilled at Project Server or whatever your project tool or process is, there's no need to rock the boat, right? I mean, I would certainly never come to an organization and say, change for the sake of change. Change for the sake of progress. And if you have PMs that are strong, they're competent, they're updating their information, and it's timely and useful, and it's adhering to a standard, you know what? Buy them a cup of coffee. But there are a lot of PMs that don't have that. They're very busy. They're heavily overworked. They don't care about Project Server any more than they care about Primavera or One Page Project Manager or any of the other 3,000 tools out there. They just want to make sure that their project gets off on time. So as Constantine says, the controller is right alongside them. They're in the staff meetings. They're capturing the status. And then they're just simply saying, I'm going to just go ahead and keep this information for you. The only additional administrative burden is that often the controller and PM will touch base, quickly review the status of the schedule, and just make sure that everything is in alignment. But it certainly is not, as Constantine said, it's not a funnel where it goes team, PM, controller, PMO. It's team, PMO, controller, and then the data is now available for organizational reporting.
And just to comment on this, we have seen a lot of success that we have our business partners outside of the IT organization asking us to help them to move some of their business projects along, especially around supply chain management. And we were able to turn some projects around and get them moving within 2 months. And they've been kind of churning, you know, for years. And so there is definitely value in that efficiency and time savings when somebody can come in who has a skill to ask the right question, build the right schedule, make sure that we have the correct cost, and get things going. And once you get it rolling, you know, things start to move because PM knows what the work is. Is managing the work and the control on a biweekly basis, you know, has relevant status updates, work with the team to make sure that he understands what has happened.
Okay, I think we've got some more questions. There's one just here, or two here. Okay, sorry, I didn't see the angle.
What metrics are you using to show the success of the PMO?
Right now we're using time. We have projects, like I said, that have been sitting in the same state for a while, and we have shown that we actually can shorten the duration of the original estimates, especially around the planning, because it's the planning that takes a long time for an experienced PM. We have a number of templates, and I walk down the hallway and I see this person with a printout this big, and ask him what he was trying to do. And he was trying to fill out a scoping document, and he was looking for information to fill out every section. The project was fairly small, and you can probably do a scoping document on the back of the envelope, but he was trying to fill out a 27-page document, because that comes from an experience, right? It's like, okay, go to our internal intranet, pull out this document, and fill it out. And once you have the experience, and you know that you don't really need to do any of this, and our controllers are very well trained in the rigor, right? What do you need to do for the projects of various sizes? And we actually build that information into our schedule, because we can now filter out just the required tasks based on the rigor, complexity, and the cost of the project. So you don't need to guess.
And to add to that, to get into more specific details, if you have an organization that's been traditionally good at tracking things like CPI or SPI, earn value, whatever, you will have some sort of trend analysis. So the easiest way to determine the value of this new relationship with the PMO as a service is to watch that trend. Right. If you have an organization that has been tracking CPI and you can now see, or SPI, and you can now see quicker turnarounds in terms of getting status updates, getting objectives taken care of, the PM has more time to focus, you can see that immediately. I'll tell you, though, that in my experience, a lot of PM organizations have no way, no record, no way to say, how do my projects work? And that often becomes the biggest stumbling block to doing project execution. They have no metrics. Oh, we just sort of get it done. We run about 30% over budget every year, and someone yells at us, then we move on. So, you know, just the ability to capture metrics, where before you just couldn't get all the PMs off the table, the same data set, the same timeline, the same reporting, just having that baseline to start tracking information often ends up being the largest indicator of success in this sort of deployment.
We also, just to add to that, we also have a matrix around cost. We had a hard time spending the money that we allocate in the beginning of the year because of the poor visibility into our resource utilization. We didn't really do a proper demand forecasting, so we couldn't spend the money fast enough. Right now, we are tracking what is our forecasted, and we are on a monthly basis. We can see what our trend line is and where we're going to be at the end of the year. And we definitely see that we're closing the gap because of the efficiencies in project execution.
Thank you.
Hi. So in my organization, we've historically had a bit of a problem with the project controller role, and it was kind of based on the fact that what they ended up becoming was project managers' dog's bodies. So because the project manager had delegated, you can write this status report, you can update the plan, you can update my risks and issues log, actually some of those items fell into disrepair and the PM became too far away from it. The way that we managed to make it work was that the PMO actually worked for the program director rather than the project manager. So then they focused their time more on the value add tasks that you talked mm-hmm. about earlier on, as opposed to making sure that the project manager's car was clean and the laundry was collected, etc. Yeah. I just wondered what your views were on that and how you made it work.
Yeah. This was exactly the point that why we have decided to go to a PMO as a service. Our people no longer time write into projects, because once you put a full-time controller onto the project, they will make coffee, clean your car, do your laundry, just like you said. And the PMs will not give up control of that resource. They will always find something for them to do. And it's communication, business change management activities that generally fall within the domain of the project manager. If we provide a service, create a schedule, we're there, we create a schedule, we provide bi-weekly updates, and we're done. If we are there to manage the financials, right, we do just that. And we found that we can maximize the controller time across projects greatly. We see before we had one controller allocated to two projects. And, you know, you see this person doing things or getting the messages that, why are you doing this? Well, the PM asked me to do that, right? I work for him. And so while the project manager, while the controllers are a value add for the project managers, they're a control element for the PMO, mm-hmm. right? We ensure the data quote and everything else. But so that model, that shared services model, helps us to manage their time and make sure that they focus just on the providing the services instead of these other activities.
So just a quick question from me to add to that. Did you actually define clearly the roles that the PMO and the service was mm-hmm. going to deliver? And did you get to the degree of service level agreements that we will provide these services to this level of?
So let me touch a little bit about the services. Every mm-hmm. service has a customer-facing description, basically what the customer is going to get. On the backside, it has a how-to guide, which mm-hmm. outlines exactly the steps that a PM, that a controller needs to do to complete a service. And also, with the introduction of Project Server, we are tracking historical data around how long the service takes to produce. And we are tracking these bases of estimates so we can tell projects, you know, here's how much you need to budget for us to create a schedule and maintain the schedule for you for the duration of the project. Regarding the service level agreement, we don't have specific SLAs in place how long it is going to take. Mm. We are gathering data, and we will be providing, right? It becomes the basis of estimate how much and how long it will be taken. And I think having that system to track the historical data and actuals is very important for us.
Okay. Just to follow up on your question, I think it's interesting. Your organization actually went through the journey I outlined initially. You had controllers that were in a PMO that had a fairly ill-defined role, so they got misused. That's just the nature of the business, right? So you went through that process where you learned two things I pointed out, right? One, that the PMO needs to own that role so that the line of authority goes directly to the PMO. And second, that you need a well-defined catalog of services, right? Can you do my risk management? No. It's not within our role. And when you have those lines clearly defined, you know, good fences make good neighbors, right? So in the same sense, clearly defined roles make for clearly defined relationships. So it's actually great that your organization sort of went through that and found the kind of light through the tunnel. Has it now, out of curiosity, has it actually improved your project performance now that these controllers and project managers are now operating a bit more comfortably? Have you seen gains? That's great. Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, and echo, you know, I had the same exact question as you did. But just on top of that, is really having a project scheduler really more a band-aid to say, I wish I had better PMs or, you know, people who have graduated in the organization, thank you for your service. You've been there for a long time and you really are SMEs, but maybe you're not a PM and shouldn't be a PM and should be more of a BA or something else that is helping the program. A project and let a real project manager step in here? I mean, do you feel that maybe some, you know, a project schedulers or an analyst or, you know, coordinator, I mean, those other names that pop into my mind, is it really not just a band-aid? Costly one?
Well, I think one thing I would say, as a project management consultant, I've seen a lot of people who say they are project managers. Some of them even have PMP certifications. And I've seen a lot of those people be very, very poor project managers. There are people who adhere to schedules like they are religious documents, and it does not matter what their schedule or the actual project looks like. There are people who manage their projects on sticky notes and never know what's going on. I would say, just in my experience, project management it's a discipline. It's a skill set. It'd be like, I mean, I'm not going to say it's like asking a mechanic to do brain surgery, but I mean, you know, it's like anything else. If you're an automotive mechanic versus a aircraft mechanic, these are defined skills you have to have. Project managers need to have not just technical expertise, and I'm not talking about project schedules and project server, but I mean, you know, the ability to interact with a team, the ability to keep a team disciplined in an approach, and the ability to interface up and down the chain to get all their work done in a timely fashion. And these are skills that, over the years, you can accumulate. And when you get to that point, you may, in fact, be able to be a project manager. A lot of PMs are incidental project managers. They come to the organization as something else and learn that. And that's fine. The problem organizations have is when they run out of PMs and they just start shoehorning anyone that can keep a schedule in place in there. And that's where you see, as Constantine said, a lot of these BA PMs.
The gentleman, I think, on the left there.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you. I knew someone would do it. Excellent. Beautiful. Thank you. That was...
Sorry, could you just get the glass of scotch?
Now it's a fireside chat.
I have a question. I'm having a little bit of a hard time. Very early on, you mentioned about the PMO being... or project teams opting in for the PMO services. Mm-hmm. But yet everything we've just talked about in the last few minutes speaks to a need for some consistency in our schedules and our resource assignments, because the project, you also said that the project organizations are driven by data. Mm-hmm. And so I'm having a hard time reconciling how a project could choose not to use the PMO.
So if you, like Ken said, if you have a PM that is very capable and versed in Microsoft Project Server and just in general project, and can keep a good schedule, can manage the budget, so as long as they meet the requirements, we want to drive the behavior, right? And if they have the capability and they said, you know, by the way, you know, I can do all of this. Here's my schedule. Here's my budget. We take a look at it and so fine, great. The problem that we're seeing is that people that are doing it well, they're very forthcoming with their information. People that are not given a schedule, people are, that are canceling meetings, people are pushing back. Why do I need to do this? I don't want to do this. I'm fine with Excel. I'm just going to give you a list of milestones. And the people that are not doing it very well. So it's a red flag right away, and so if you ask 100 projects for their schedules and you get 10 back, you know, maybe these 10 people can do that, and maybe they will become an early adopters and they don't need to use a scheduling. But even people that do it well, they ask us, they see the value in that because it allows for the PM to manage the project, right? To engage with stakeholders. The majority of our projects are global projects. We have teams. Delivering org across the world. We have stakeholders across the world, and it's not uncommon for the PM. If I have to have a meeting with Brazil, France, Singapore, and Philippines, the only time I can do it is 1 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm. And you know, just to add to that, your point was valid about sort of the push versus pull, right? I think that you know one thing that I would say we didn't cover in the earlier slides, but whenever you are introducing change in an organization, you have to have senior level support, right? So one thing that you would not do this in isolation. This would be part of an organizational change approach where you have people from up above saying, we have a new path, we're looking for these data elements, these schedules, this timeline, something that is now driving change in the organization so that people understand that there is a kind of a new wind blowing through the town. Where you see the value of the PMO as a service and where the PM or the project team see their value is that they're now being told, hey, I now have to report on this stuff. And so basically you're being told, here are three things you hate. You now have to do this every other week. So the PMO comes in sort of like a project management drug pusher and says, well, hey, you know what? I can do that for you for a very small price. You know, I can take the schedule, I can take the time, I can take the cost, I can help you do this stuff. You focus on making your project awesome, I'll focus on making your project look awesome to the senior management. And so it's not always, as you said, it's not always clean. There are PMs who are territorial. They want no one to touch their stuff. You know, I would never, again, push change for change's sake. But if you define a value, define a need, and then you provide a service that says, I will help you with that need, we found at Chevron, and I've seen it in some other organizations, people will seek for these individuals just to help get that stuff pushed through the system.
So the project managers right now are in very high demand, and it's very hard to secure project managers. In addition, we see a lot of project managers that are coming, a lot of senior project managers, that are coming into the field after being successful engineers, successful supervisors, and they've risen through the functional track. So while they are very good at emotional intelligence, and we put them through all this great soft skill training, and they're able to interact with any level of stakeholders, they're able to manage our contractuals and work with vendors on $5 billion project, a lot of them are missing that basic expertise that you get if you are coming, you know, from a junior PM control type of background where you understand the project management basic skills. So if you, and a lot of these functional experts that got into project management, they have domain knowledge. And in energy business, domain knowledge is fairly important. In chemical business, it's really important because you work with maintenance and reliability, refineries. There's just it's impossible to bring in fresh PM and for them to be able to go and talk to maintenance and reliability folks. If you don't speak the same language, they won't work with you. They need to be able to explain to somebody, and they need to speak the same language, the same lingual. So to take that successful and effective PM that have risen there and pair them up with a controller allows you to marry both up and get the value, where the PM is not struggling, you know, to update the schedule or to figure out how to create a schedule. But at the same time, you have a controller that comes in there, asks the right questions, work with the team, get the schedule, and the PM focuses on doing all the work.
Yeah, and you know, just to add to that, part of the answer is yes, of course. If you have a PM that's just flat out terrible, replace them, right? But oftentimes the better question is why, right? And can you help this PM by either using a PMO or using some other training? As Constantine pointed out, sometimes just a matter of getting them a helping hand. You know, maybe they're basically competent PMs, but are really struggling with the project. So shifting that burden may improve their ability. An interesting kind of funny side effect of these sort of controller roles, which are, as you're hearing, they're more than just project schedules, like project controls analysts. They're sort of like mini PMs in a way, is that you kind of slowly breed up good project managers in your organization. So you have a controller working with a PM, and they are absorbing good practices from this controller and actually can tend to improve their game. But, I mean, certainly I've seen PMs that are causing active harm to the success of the organization, and those people you would definitely not want to keep in any of that sort of role. So yeah, there's always a time to keep, a time to supplement.
You mentioned that you have some data on how much time the controlling is taking. How much does it save of a PM's time? Say like it was 15% of a project, does it cut it down to 12%? What kind of data do you have?
So what we're seeing right now, and again, it's on a bigger scale, we see projects that have not been able to kick off for months and months. And we have the controller coming in, and the projects start to move. We are not that far along where we can have a consistent data point that we have been able to, since the introduction of the controllers, we see the efficiency of 3-4% over your phase 1, 2, or 3 of the project. But we will be tracking that. It's extremely important to us to be able to quantify the benefits and the efficiency that we're getting. Right now, we are showing the improvement in weeks and months over what was originally estimated.
Yeah. And organizations I've worked with, PMs will often tell me that they spend at least one day a week just updating their project status, at least a day a week, just doing nothing but looking at a tool and click, 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 click. So if you just look at that as just a very baseline metric, you have a PM or a controller that's assigned to do 40 hours of work across, say, 5 projects, you're, in fact, actually saving up to 20% of that PM's time. It's hard to tell because it depends on what the PM and what they're doing and what they're working on. But generally, what you're looking at is a reduction in administrative overhead, usually no less than 10% of a PM's time, sometimes 20 or even 30, depending on the organization's reporting requirements. It could get quite intensive after a while, actually. Very beneficial.
Lady down the front here. Just while the mic's coming down, for the project management community, the intelligent project management community, the benefits seem pretty obvious, the value add. What about the C-suite? What is the CIO, the CFO, the CEO? What are they thinking about this potentially additional layer of cost that they're building into their organization?
There are two ways to approach it, right? You can view this as cost, or you can view this as you're spending money to get money back. And this is a case where we're getting the money back. Like I said, the efficiency is there. We can clearly show that we can free up the people managing projects to kick off other projects by taking on the administrative part of the project management for them. So there is cost saving there because we can get to more projects. But also we're talking about data quality and portfolio level decision making. Because we have the controllers, standard tools and templates and a common technology platform, and every project is doing it consistently, we're able to aggregate the data from the project level to any type of program portfolio, OPCO level, and then to the enterprise level on a biweekly basis, and instead of waiting until the end of the quarter to figure out, where do we stand in terms of cost, schedule, how well are we doing, our C-level executive can take a look at the visual dashboard on a biweekly basis to see how well their portfolio is performing. And it's for individual BU or it's, for the downstream and chemical overall.
I mean, just well, actually, if I can just add to that. So, you know, in my experience with the C-suite is that, you know, I can usually sum up their relationship with project statuses in three words. They hate waiting. You know, these are people who are doing a lot of stuff every day, and they don't want to spend a lot of time trying to guess what the heck they're looking at on a page. They want to look at a thing, see the red dots, know what's going wrong, and know what you're fixing. So first and foremost, you can sell the PMO as a service, as Valiant say, I tell you what, you know, we put this tool in place, we put these people in place, you're going to get useful data like that. It's not going to be like the old days where it's the Wild West, this is 2 weeks at a day, this is a different metric, consistent quality data. The second element is, anyone in the room a Scrum Master by chance? So those that are Scrum, I'm one as well. You know, they tell you that, you know, how do you sell the value of a Scrum Master? Well, it's an easy answer. Every week I make the design team more efficient. So every week I can measure my value and how much more output my design team did than the week before that. Same idea with the PMO, PMO as a service specifically. You know, if you have metrics that say we do Y projects in X time, you can use the PMO as a service, use these controllers or whatever implementation method you use, and you can show the value of increased efficiency, which translates into dollars.
I'd like to know if PMO as a service can be used successfully if it's a hybrid approach or adoption, meaning in my organization, I've got a pretty highly skilled set of PMs, and they do a pretty good job of managing the standards. We work on strategic initiatives, but the light to medium-sized projects are taken over by business analysts or engineers. So they're the ones that do need help. Would it be possible to have a PMO organization where you are providing this as a service to other non-PMs and be successful at adopting it into a PMO organization where the other PMs are managing their strategic initiatives on their own?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that the key point here is service, right? So, you know, we don't, you know, McDonald's doesn't come to your house and make you buy their burgers. You know, you want a burger from McDonald's, you go to McDonald's to get that burger. So in the same sense, the idea that, and again, that's going back to what I said earlier, that's the primary difference between the PMO as a service versus the traditional PMO. A traditional PMO might come in and say, here's what I'm going to make you do for me every week. The PMO as a service says, here's what I can do for you if you let me help you. And, you know, you may have some organizational requirements where you say, hey, if you're not like a PM of a certain level of skill, you need to use a controller. That can or can't work depending on your organization. But certainly, as Constantine said earlier, you know, your high-functioning PMs, maybe their only involvement with controllers is just some small administrative work. Just kind of, you know, they could be schedule checkers. Just make sure that the scheduled data is all hitting the right bullets and you're done. For those BAs or junior PMs who are struggling much more, you certainly would then offer the service, hey, look, you know, we know you guys are new, you're kind of a green PM, you're on a very complicated project, let's help you move along. So again, the whole idea of this concept is that it's now a service. We are helping people get better. If you don't need the help, you don't need the service. If you don't want the burger, eat healthy.
I think just to add to that, if you can drive that consistency in your data model across these, your roadmap projects that are doing extremely well, strategic initiatives, and what these, you know, the projects that are managed by the BAs to ensure that when you report, you are reporting across a common data set. That would, I guess, what I would add to that.
Hey, Constantine, how are you? Good to see you. Two questions. One is, how do you charge for the services? Is it the PMO totally funded, or do the clients that are the people, the projects that use it, do they? How do you pay for that? How do you set that up in your cost center structure? And the second part of the question, maybe more towards Ken, is who do you think the PMO should be reporting to in a general sense? Should it be the C-level? Should it be, as you see, PMOs pop up all over the place in organizations? What would be your recommendation around that?
Sure.
Cost is a great question. Right now, we have some projects that are paying for controllers, so we started with them. We worked with them for several months. They saw the value. We told them that, you know, we're going to have to charge you. They realized that what they're paying was reasonable, and they were able to recover that cost in the efficiency. We also have some of the smaller projects that have not budgeted for the controllers where it is funded directly by the CIO. We fund a group of controllers for the organization, and we track how much time we spend on each individual project to make sure that, you know, we tell them, hey, you know, if you want to manage a $50,000 project in this area that have this many resources, vendor involvement, no vendor involvement, you know, we feel that it's, you know, your scheduling will cost this much, your budget services will be this much and your reporting will be this much. So right now it's a hybrid model because we are just kicking off. We will be using these bases of estimates that we're tracking as a way to create the pricing structure for services based on the size complexity of the project.
And just to add on to that, so I think one of the things that's kind of cool about this is that, no one person is absorbing the cost of a controller into their project. So if you look at it as a simple billing model, let's say you have a PMO that has, let's say 10 controllers and a PMO lead or a PMO manager. Let's just keep it simple. The PMO controllers in the organization are billing 10 hours a week here, 5 hours a week there. So your individual project may be picking up, let's say they're being paid, $80 an hour times 5 hours a week. So that's your cost for a project controller. The project controller is working 40 hours a week across 10 different projects. So each individual project takes a very small chunk of cost, but gets the full value of the controller. Meanwhile, the 100% of your controller salary or your cost is now being defrayed among a variety of projects. So it actually ends up working fairly well. The only real overhead would be kind of additional administrative functions, maybe the PMO manager. But you're able to kind of get the bulk of your PMO bodies out into the projects and then splitting that cost among all those projects. So I think the second part of your question, did you have another comment on that?
No.
Okay, well, he had a second question I wanted to answer. He had asked about placement of the PMO in an organization. So I think I mentioned this earlier. A traditional PMO has to be placed actually fairly highly in an organization. When you have a PMO that is a governance-based body, it needs to generally report to a C-suite. If it's like, for example, an IT PMO, should almost always have a direct line to either a very senior VP or the CIO himself. Because at the end of the day, let's admit the ugly truth. If I'm a PM and you tell me I have to give you some sort of status report every week, but you can't really make me, well, this week was really busy. Sorry. I'll get to you next week. You know what? My data last week's not that much different. We're fine.
So just to add to that, Ken, before joining P-Cubed, I was a CIO of a $10 billion turnover company, and the PMO reported into me directly.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah.
Sorry, lady at the back. Question.
Hi there. Do you look at the size of the project when you decide to assign a controller to it, or take in consideration, like, if there's a small project versus a large project? And the second part of the question is, when you do look at that, about how many projects do you think a controller can effectively manage on a weekly basis?
So right now, because we're just trying to load up all of the data into the system, all of the projects are assigned to controllers. And it's usually the smaller projects that struggles. You have a BA who has a $7,000 or $8,000, $20,000 project assigned to him that he needs to complete within 1 year. You come to the end of the year and they're not done. What happened? Well, I was busy supporting these applications and doing other things. Okay, we'll do them next year, right? And so year after year, these lists pile up. So if we can help them clear this backlog and spend the money, there's a lot of value in that. Big projects, some of the big projects will actually use a full-time controller because of how much, how big the schedules are and how big the finance cycle is. If you have 150 resources that are time writing and you have to ensure that their time was appropriately split between CapEx and OpEx, and you have vendor invoices that are coming in and you need to reconcile that against your original budget, there's just a lot that controller needs to do. And I don't know how some project management used to do it in the past on a larger project when you had to do everything yourself, schedule and all the financials, run all of the reporting. It's tough.
Yeah. I think it depends, as Constantine said, it depends really on two things, the kind of the strength of the individual controller and the amount of work they have to do. I worked with PG&E up in Northern California, and they had a project control analyst, which was sort of similar, but it was much more schedule focused. So they used a rubric of like 1 to 2 large projects, which they expressed as a certain number of complex tasks, excuse me, or cost and a schedule, overall cost for a project, maybe 5 to 8 medium projects, then anywhere from maybe a dozen to upwards of 20 small projects. And they had their own individual metrics for what they considered a small, medium, large project. But I think it's, you have to understand what your controller can handle and then how much you're expecting them to do. And a lot of times it can be simply looked at as how many hours a week does it currently take to do this work times how many hours a week your controller is actually working for you. And that ends up being a pretty simple method. If they're doing 10 projects that require 4 hours of work each, that's a work week. And that's how many projects they should probably do based on the reporting cycle.
So just to add to that, currently we have about 12 to 20 active projects that are assigned to a controller. If we are looking at a new portfolio right now for OneUpco, and there are about 40 initiatives at various stages that are assigned to a controller, and the controller works through with the people that are assigned to that line item to figure out where is this project at? Is it on hold? Is it canceled? And once they update the system, usually they end up between 12 and 20 projects.
Thank you. Any other?
So just a closing comment. We are starting, like Ken said, we need to have a place where we're going to start. And we're starting with schedule, budget, resource management piece, and the reporting. But as we mature and as we're able to standardize and get everybody on board, we're looking to introduce additional services. Part of it is business change management. Business change management consultants are very expensive. And if you get this on a project, you know, this cost balloons. So to be able to provide this as a shared service is it's another value-added activity that the PMO can produce. Risk management, we are planning to do it in the near future because we're trying to get the risk-based scheduling approach to make sure that we allocate contingency against a very specific set of risks. And there is a lot that PMO can do within the shared model. So don't limit yourself just to schedule cost and reporting.
Okay, so just to wrap up, we've got a few points here on summary. Ken, would you like to give your thoughts on that?
Certainly. So I think, you know, the big three takeaways in my mind with the PMO as a service model is, you know, first and foremost, that big change. We offer value. It's not about imposing requirements. It's about enabling clicker, cleaner project management. You know, the traditional PMO model looks sort of like a funnel, right? You pour a bunch of data into it, and it distills it out to a central source. But think about a funnel. What happens when you put too much water into it? It overflows and spills everywhere. I like to think of the PMO as a service as sort of like a vacuum cleaner. It sucks up all the data, and then it has it there for whoever wants to reach in the bag and pull it out. So you are, you know, you're no longer this push-pull model where you're pushing PMs to get this status and then pulling the data out of them and not actually moving anywhere forward. You're doing kind of a pull-push model. You are pulling the data from the project with the assistance of the PMs, and then you are pushing it forward to whoever needs to take that data. So right there, you're kind of using a natural sort of energy to move the projects through your organization much more cleanly by delivering value rather than requiring bureaucracy. The second point, I think, and then we have Constantine weigh in as well, is that, you know, PMO can do a lot of things. And a lot of your PMOs probably do a lot of things. And it's quite possible that a lot of your PMOs don't do a lot of those things very well. So whenever I work with an organization that wants to put a PMO in place, I ask them, where does it hurt? What's the pain point? You know, you can tell me what you want, but what we need to get to is what you need. And it may be that what you need is a considerably smaller subset of pieces of information. And that's where you start. Start there, get that working, incremental change, grow into what you want to do with that PMO. So don't try to do too much, because it's sort of like trying to grab water. The wider your grasp, the less that will actually end up in your hands. And I think the last point is that, you know, people, prize, you know, Constantine said several times, people, processes, tools. These are all important. But at the end of the day, in order to get good data, you need a good place to put that data. And, you know, just to shout out to the people that are sponsoring us here today, you know, Project Server has actually been a very effective tool in doing that. They integrate collaboration via SharePoint. They have a good, you know, BI reporting center, SSRS reporting. There are a lot of ways to centralize your data and then provide it across the organization. And even if you don't use SharePoint or Project Server, having a tool that lets you centralize and collect this data, enforce some rigors and some standards, will dramatically improve your ability to then turn around and say, okay, what do we want to do in 6 months, 12 months, 2 years' time? So the technology piece is important as the people and the processes. Sir?
You know, and just while you're focusing on the low-hanging fruit and immediately the things that are bringing value, immediate value to your organization, you still have to keep the long-term vision in place and to have that vision, because that will enable you to create the data model and to set up your system in such a way for future growth. Because if you just plan, you know, here's what we're going to do without any future outlook, you may limit yourself where you're going to have to redo some of these processes in the future if you decide to expand or to grow your offering, your PMO offering.
Okay, so thank you very much for your input and those wonderful questions. And finally, thanks to Constantine and Ken for their insights. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.